How did you get from sculpting and the history of art into video art? How did that shift take place?
Yeah, so, you know, it's funny. I was going to be a doctor, actually. And I fell into art because I was struck by this teacher who told me, this guy, Ron Jones, and he said, hey, art actually can change the world. You know, you can impact culture. You can get people talking about things. So, you know, that seemed like hopelessly an idealistic and maybe a naive statement, but this guy didn't strike me as naive. And I decided that it would make sense to try to get into this in a professional way, trying to produce culture, trying to get people to think about things, trying to raise questions in a non-didactic way, in a poetic way. And I was drawn to building things, but I started to realize that I wanted to tell stories. And film seemed like such a natural medium for me to try to really immerse myself in. And so after working as a sculptor and teaching for a while and exhibiting in New England, where I was from, I'm from Boston, I decided to move to LA, study with Mike Kelly and Stephen Prina and Patty Podesta. And there was just a lot of really great video art happening in LA at this place, Art Center. And it was wonderful. And it was a way for me to introduce story, and specifically stories from my life, from my pursuit about trying to figure out some of the big questions. And a lot of the big questions were, for me, the big questions that I was really interested in were, how does one figure out how to be an ethical person outside of organized religion, outside of institutional convention? And it seemed to me that that was a really important question to pursue. And it's something that I'm trying to work on now in relationship to this project, the Sharing Project, which is about, how does one figure out how much to share in our capitalist system?
So do you miss anything from the tactile nature of creating a specific three-dimensional art form versus video installation or not?
Well, I think about sculpture in a really large way, as opposed to necessarily like a steel object or a wooden object that I was making when I was in college and afterwards. I think that video installation is actually very much a sculpture because it's thinking about space. And so if there's a multi-channel installation, first of all, it's challenging the convention of looking at a moving image in a theater with your popcorn and your various candies, and the screen is a bit curved. So I feel like I've been experimenting and developing structural ways, both in terms of how I sequence images, which is about structure, which I think is related to sculpture, but also about the relationship between the different components in an installation, which can be multiple videos, but also objects. For example, I did this video installation about this tree that I adopted in the middle of a giant parking lot called Sycamore, and it's a video tree sculpture. So the video equipment itself is a sculpture of the tree, and there's 12 films that are celebrating this tree that no one cared about. And the videos celebrate the tree, but also chronicle my attempts to improve its life. And there's a movie version of it, which, you know, is presented on the big screen for film festivals and that kind of thing. But the installation, the art exhibitions were very much sculptural, and that's how I really think about it. If it's going to be in a space like in a gallery or museum, then I try to engage that space in a physical way. And I feel like once you're doing that, then you're thinking about it in terms of sculpture. I also have built things in my film practice. Like I built giant earrings for the tree. I was facilitating a large public art installation in relationship to Sycamore, where I was planting offspring of the tree all over California, and I was asking people, especially at schools, to make sculptures to adorn these trees. So those were very much sculptures. So I'm doing it. You know, I built this hand-carved sculpture for this project, Pumping, and there were train tracks in that exhibition, so very sculptural, and there are these giant piles of metal and, you know, multiple videos. So in a lot of ways, I feel like I'm very much a sculptor, but I've introduced story into these sculptures now, which is something that I was really trying to figure out how to do for a really long time.
And we should point out, Sycamore is spelled S-I-C-K-Amour, the French spelling for love, A-M-O-U-R. And I just found that a fascinating project. I think it's a great entree into kind of how you think in the broader perspective on what is art and how does it impact society. What was the ultimate impact of that film?
I'm really happy with that project because it reinforced this belief that art can actually facilitate change. So at first it was me talking about this tree, making a film about this tree, and it was having a really hard time. It was hit by cars, starved for water and oxygen.
It was in a parking lot?
In a massive parking lot, just surrounded by asphalt. And that seemed to be a microcosm of where we are as a larger culture, forgotten individuals. You know, what about the little guy? Like, who cares about this tree? Who cares about any particular individual? Hopefully lots of people, but there's people who fall through the cracks, and this tree was falling through the cracks. And in terms of environmentalism, yeah, we take care of our national parks, but there's all these things in our expanding cities. And so what happens with them? So it had a very small tree pit. It was having a really hard time. But I, at first, through some guerrilla action, I put metal tree guards around the tree. But then I started talking to people, and the art and the film started generating some buzz, and ended up talking to council members in Pasadena and then talking to the Rose Bowl. And eventually they agreed to remove 400 square feet of asphalt around the tree and to protect it permanently with boulders. And not only that, the city of Pasadena started removing asphalt around other parking lot trees and protecting them with boulders as well. So there was an awakening of the importance of taking care and nurturing these trees in the cities. On top of that, after I made the art installation, you know, the tree had no chance to reproduce, but there was literally 200, I call them tree babies, planted throughout Southern California, schools, parks, museums, and some of them are huge. Like the one in front of the USC Art School, I think is about 100 feet tall already. So other people started caring for these trees. And then my suspicion is that hopefully it's led to, in other places as well, people rethinking or caring for trees in parking lots and in their cities. Maybe it increased that to some degree. And I feel like it did. So yeah. I'm proud of that. And I saw it concretely. So when people say, oh, yeah, art can't impact culture or it can't have political impact, I respectfully disagree because I've seen that on the ground.
Well, from Sycamore and an installation and project and follow-up and a lot of other activities about caring and environmental concerns, now you shift to a focus on sharing and an issue or a notion that's self-described confusing to you.
Yeah, I feel like it's very much linked to Sycamore in a lot of ways, as you just said. And I think there's a connection between trying to figure out to what extent or to interact and how to behave in relationship to our environment and how to interact with our neighbors or other human beings. And sharing seems to be fundamental to that question because I think it's really about ethics. How much should we be directing what we have and our energies towards ourselves and towards other people? And trying to figure out that, how to behave, how to be a good person, is very confusing, but I think it's something that I believe should be a larger part of our conversation than it might be now. And I'm trying to do this in a rigorous way, in an interdisciplinary way, and also in a personal way, and trying to bring up some questions in those manners without being didactic. It's a very personal question for me right now because I'm a dad and a relatively new dad. Allison and I have two boys. Zeke is our oldest. He's 3 years old right now. And Ozzy is our second child. And I began this project a few months before Ozzy was born. I realized that as a dad, I was going to have to teach Zeke to share or to teach him about sharing. But it was something that I didn't really understand. And so I wanted to both look at him and try to think about things with a really open mind. I felt like if I made art about it too, it might help me figure it out. Because as an artist, as a filmmaker, I knew that would be a way for me to really devote myself to this question. And just like in my other projects, I felt like the attempt to try to figure this out could be an interesting story.
What were your initial questions, seeing those issues play out in Zeke and his interaction with other kids?
I started filming this when Zeke was around 20 months old. And so I've been filming him and filming this project for already a year and a half. I went to school with him one day and, you know, first of all, let me just say, I'm not just saying this as his dad, but he's a really sweet kid. He doesn't strike me or other people as an aggressive boy in any way. But it was amazing to me when I went to school with him that there were all these conflicts that were occurring with him and with all these other boys. It was mostly with boys, interestingly, at least on that particular day, about who had access to what. Like, these were all communal toys. This was at a preschool, and I'd imagine there would be a lot more conflicts if the kids were bringing in their favorite personal things. So even with the communal things that were ostensibly for everyone, there were all these conflicts. The first one happened when Zeke was playing with a ball, and this other kid came up to him and just tried to take it from him. And so, I mean, clearly, it would seem, at least at first glance, that Zeke had the right to that ball. He had it first. This other guy was trying to take it from him, but maybe not. I mean, like, you know, there's ideas of, like, turn the other cheek. Maybe he should have just given this kid the ball. I mean, my impulse would be, which was identical to Zeke, would be to retain that ball, to hold on to the ball he was playing with at first. He had the right to it. And a teacher intervened and let Zeke continue playing with the ball. But even that doesn't seem entirely like a simple question. Then moments later, there is another ball that is rolling around like outside of Zeke's field of view. Another boy had been playing with it, but he dropped it. Zeke didn't realize this other boy was playing with the ball, so he went to get the ball. The other kid went to get the ball too, so they reached there at the same moment, and they're, of course, struggling for the ball. So Zeke doesn't understand why he should relinquish that ball. They both think they have a claim to the ball. The teacher comes and says that this other kid has the right to have that ball, but that, of course, is upsetting to Zeke, because why should he believe the teacher just because the teacher is a voice of authority? Also, like, who has the right, just because the kid had it first, does that mean that he has the continued right to keep having the ball? Probably, but I don't know, like, it's not obvious. And then, again, soon after that, there's another incident that happens. Zeke has a ball, another kid has a ball, and Zeke is having a good time with his ball, but this other boy seems to be having even more fun with the ball. And so Zeke thinks to himself, or at least I think he thinks to himself, wait a minute. I want to have as much fun as this other kid. I want to have that ball. Even though I have this ball, I want another ball. And so he goes and tries to take that ball from the kid. Now, that seems wrong. And the teacher thought it was wrong and stopped Zeke from trying to take that ball. But when I was thinking about it, I was like, well, yeah, that does make sense. But we're in a culture that seems to applaud selfishness and even greed in all these different ways. I mean, so why are we teaching our kids to share or to not take the extra ball when we applaud accumulation in all these ways? So are we being consistent? And that became a really fundamental question for me in this project that I wanted to try to explore. Are we being consistent, and why are we teaching sharing?
Okay. These are really huge issues, and they extend far beyond just sharing a ball.
Yeah. So I'm trying to figure this out, and I know that I certainly can't figure it out on my own. So I've been reaching out to a lot of people in a lot of different fields. They include trying to understand if we're actually teaching sharing or are we pretending to teach sharing. So I've been talking to Zeke's teachers and his potential teachers, principals at other schools. I've been talking to psychologists. I've been talking to evolutionary biologists. I've been talking to anthropologists. I've been talking to philosophers, philosophers of science, historians, local activists. And the more people that I talk to, amazingly, in some ways, the less clarity that there is, because it seems like there's additional layers of complexity that keep opening up.
Give me an example.
I was really struck. I got into thinking a lot about evolutionary biology, and I was talking to this fascinating man at Duke named Alex Rosenberg, and he was talking about how it seems like, and there's been a lot of disagreement in the field over time since Darwin about the fundamental question would be, well, if it's all about competition, then why are we altruistic at all? And there's various theories. I mean, one has to do with kin selection, like we're nice to people that we're related to because on a selfish level in terms of the gene, maybe if we're good to someone who's related to us, that benefits us in some way. Or maybe we're good to people, we share with people if we think that there's a chance of reciprocity. So Zeke might share to someone if he thinks that that person will share back with him down the road. Or he might, in terms of kin, he might share more easily with Ozzy than he does with some stranger. And those are things that I recognize in myself in some level too. But the thing that really struck me was this idea that's been popularized more lately called multi-level selection, which is that fundamentally we're conflicted. On the level of the group, there's group selection that encourages us to cooperate with each other, to share with each other, because if a group cooperates, then it's likely to be stronger than other groups. But at the same time, we're wired to cheat and steal and to be selfish within that group to get ahead. And so we're fundamentally conflicted. And that just really blew my mind, because I recognize that. I'm like, oh my God, yes. I mean, I want to have a nice life for myself, for Allison, for our boys, for Zeke and Ozzy. But at the same time, there's part of me that feels that I'm not doing enough for others. There's a philosopher, Christian Miller, who's here at Wake Forest, who was telling me that even though there's all these different models for ethics, for how to be in this world, they're conflicting, but they all point to the idea that we're not doing enough. That really resonates for me. And I was talking to Adrian Barden and some other philosophers as well. And I was thinking about this philosopher, G.A. Cohen, who makes an argument for socialism. And his argument goes like this. He says, when we go camping, no one thinks that one person should have more food than the other on a camping trip. No one thinks that one person has the right for a bigger tent. We all agree that all the food should be shared equally. And so if we believe that, then how come there's so much inequity? Like, if that's true, perhaps we should be distributing all wealth equally across all borders. Now, that seems politically very difficult, if not impossible. You know, and part of me believed that, but part of me also wanted to have a nice life, nice things for myself and for my family. And there's plenty of arguments, plenty of philosophers that would think that that's totally fine. So where's the line? And how does one figure that out? I think that initially I felt that, okay, yes, even though I'm not living my life that way, I probably should be. And so I started teaching Zeke, and Allison and I were both doing this, teaching him to share everything. Even though I wasn't sharing everything, I wasn't letting Zeke use my video camera, even go into my office, barely ever. I was asking him to share all his toys with all his friends. So he had this friend come over who was playing with all his stuff, and they were having a great time and they were sharing really well together. And then this friend wanted to play with Zeke's special guitar. And I tried to get him to take turns with the guitar, and eventually they did. First they were fighting, and then Zeke reluctantly agreed, and then he would beautifully took turns, and they were playing guitar. One played, the other listened, the other played, the other one listened. And that was beautiful. And I asked Zeke about it the next day, and he's like, yeah, that was cool, but he didn't want to do it. And I was like, you know what? You're right. Like, why should you have to share your special guitar? That doesn't seem right. I'm not doing that in my office or with my camera or other things. So it just struck me that there has to be this line, but the line where we are in this country seems to be very, 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 very far away to the right. And socialism is not even discussed. G.A. Cohen may not be, you know, entirely correct, but clearly there's a lot of inequities here.
Looking at the concept of sharing from so many different angles from people who study this stuff, it must have been a great learning experience. What was another example of somebody who kind of, you know, rocked your world in terms of the way you approach this topic?
David Graeber really, at first I read his book about debt. It really just impressed me and made me rethink a lot of things.
David behind the Occupy Wall Street movement.
Yes, he started the Occupy Wall Street movement actually even 10 years ago. Really famous and important anthropologist. He's also an anarchist. I've been talking to people from a lot of different political perspectives. I interviewed Jim Otteson here at Center for the Study of Capitalism, who was really influential, but on the other side of the political spectrum from someone like David. He talks about how there's all these other cultures. As an anthropologist, he was quick to point out that there's other cultures that share in an egalitarian, communistic kind of way, which basically means that there's no claim on a particular thing, that no one says that it's theirs. So if an Inuit hunter comes home with a walrus and his neighbor doesn't have any meat, then he will share that with his neighbor because he doesn't claim that that walrus is his. Whoever is hungry has the right to food. And there's a lot of societies like this, like the Iroquois, were also very egalitarian. So that struck me as the most pure kind of sharing. So back to Zeke's school, the toys that were there are for everyone, and no one is allowed to say that it's theirs, even though they do, but it's for everyone. Graeber was also talking about how we have those concepts actually here in capitalist America. So the public library, there's books that are for everyone. A stapler in an office, everyone has the right to it. No one says that it's my stapler. Maybe they do, but it's really other people can use it. The park, you know, everyone has the right to both use it, and also we all have responsibility to take care of it. And even though there's been inroads to privatize our air and our water, or at least definitely the water, most people would think that those are part of the public domain. So we have that here in our culture. We also have less pure kinds of sharing in our culture. Still, I was really struck when we moved down to Winston-Salem that neighbors would come over, people we didn't know, and give us gifts. And from LA, like, that was not something that was going on over there. And we were trying to figure out, like, what to do, you know? But clearly it was about forming community. There was a kind of reciprocity. Someone gives you something and then you give something back. And it was a kind of community building. And we see that in other cultures like the Tiv. And so that felt like another kind of sharing. And another kind of sharing was like not interest-bearing loans, which are very, you know, there's a history of violence. Graeber was like talking about that in relationship between interest-bearing loans and even slavery. But non-interest-bearing loans, like Zeke letting someone use his toys, that feels very much like sharing, even though it's his.
Well, I wanted to know in terms of the timing of Happyville. I want to go to Happyville next. It seems like you've discovered this perfect vehicle for exploring the notion of sharing in a socialist communal setting. How did you find it? And well, describe it for us.
Okay. Yeah, I started to think about how in America, we may not have a lot of communes anymore, but there was a time where there was a lot of socialist experiments in this country, especially the 19th century. So I started going through literally bibliographies of 19th century communes and reading up about them. And I came across this one particular one called Happyville in South Carolina, which is close to us. It really grabbed my attention because, well, there wasn't much written about it, but the little that was written about it told this story of these 50 Russian Jews who moved from New York in 1905 to start this socialist community. And they were atheists, they were socialists, they didn't speak English, they didn't know how to farm, but they were able to make this thing work, at least for a little while, for a few years. Between 1905 and 1908, they made a sawmill, they made a cotton gin, they grew food, raised livestock. There was really sandy soil. It was hard to grow anything on there. There were particularly severe weather, really, really terrible winters that made growing anything really hard. And they had a lot of trouble selling their goods for whatever reason to their neighbors. And they were poor to begin with. And so eventually they had to retreat, sell the land, and go back north. But the story really captivated me because as a Jewish guy who moved from the big city to the Carolinas, I just felt a lot of kinship with these guys. They just felt really similar to me in some way. And I just thought, well, these guys were obviously really good at sharing because they lived all together. They shared everything in an egalitarian way. So I bet that if I had talked to them, I would have learned a lot from them. And there was an article that appeared that mentioned a descendant of Happyville who I contacted. Her name is Marcia Savin, and I interviewed her. Really nice and interesting woman. And she had recordings of her uncle who had lived there. And I talked to her, and I spoke to this woman named Doris Baumgarten, who actually had an old map. No one knew where this place was. Like, they sort of knew. There was one article, a larger article, that was written about it in the 70s. And it was, you know, the, like, informative article about it. But even he didn't really know where it was.
Just someplace in South Carolina?
Well, it was near Aiken. But finding out exactly where it was not clear. So Doris had this map, and there was a nice man there named Gary Hooper, who, between these three people and myself, I was able to contact the owner. It was not clear who owned the land. It's 2,200-acre area that's used as a hunting ground now. Really nice guy, and he let me go there to film. And he didn't even know, no one knew that there was an old commune there. And it has been in the family for 50 years. The point is, it was completely off the map, and it disappeared. This utopian past was gone. And like there was barely any traces of it. And that fascinated me on a poetic level because it just struck me that we're so distant now from these ideals of this pure kind of sharing in our culture that the closest thing to me of where it happened from where I'm living now is almost entirely gone and no one knew where it was. So going back there felt like this huge opportunity to try to recapture that in myself and to look for traces of this utopian past, to try to learn from these guys who I'm sure could have taught me a lot. So I went there with my camera and I was just filming this huge, huge space. And it was wild. I mean, there was wild hogs, there's rattlesnakes, there's all this stuff. But it's beautiful. I was standing on the dam that these guys built. There was an ancient tractor that was totally falling apart, trees falling on it. This giant building that there's a very good chance that actually was used in Happyville that was completely decaying. So I'm filming the ground, these buildings, the trees, and trying to imagine and look for in some kind of poetic way what was there before. And then after filming there for quite a while, like a whole number of a bunch of days, I came back with Zeke. And Zeke has, he doesn't really play. He plays, but he likes building. He likes fixing things. He likes working with tools. He calls himself a worker man. So tools like hammers, wrenches, all that stuff's really important to him. And we went there with his tools to try to fix Happyville in a poetic or metaphysical way. There's this Jewish idea called Tikkun Olam, which is about trying to restore the world in a metaphysical sense, it's basically about trying to do good. So I thought that maybe if we went there with his tools, that maybe we can learn something about sharing and to try to fix this place. So we're working on the tractor. We're working on this old decaying home. And we're bringing his shovel and we're trying to dig and look and search in the land. And it was this beautiful day with Zeke that felt a lot of kinship both with him as well as these guys who were there 100 years ago.
Just watching that on the short, and you were in Happyville there with Zeke, working with tools at one point on the tractor itself. I was really struck by the just the rhythm of your conversation with Zeke and the pauses and kind of letting him direct. What was that moment like between you and Zeke, and what made it so special?
I had done my first film actually involved a lot of digging. And I showed it to Zeke. And so I think for a while he thought that that's what I did, that I dug. And because it was the first film I think that I showed him. And so he thought when I went in my office that I dug. And so he was really, we would practice digging together at home. So there's that layer to going there with the shovel and with the tools that it was, you know, as his dad, I feel like it's my response. I mean, he looks to me as a kind of model, but I'm also learning from him. So I think we were trying to figure things out together in Happyville, you know, and I wasn't really sure what we would find. The first project that I mentioned where I was digging, it was about trying to create one religious action outside of organized religion. And I had this impulse that if I dug and inserted myself into the ground in these different ways, that perhaps I can construct a mystical experience. And I tried all these different variables. And so that's a film, Seven Attempts to Make a Ritual, it's called. And so there's a kind of connection, I feel, to that with this project. In my mind, like the desire to try to figure out how to behave in a good way towards our environment, or towards each other or towards the divine. They're all interconnected. And so trying to engage this space and learn from it, obviously it's not about just physical interaction with the space. It's about trying to tap into it in a poetic but a metaphysical way. It was profound, and I feel like part of the profundity was linked to these other pursuits that I've had that probably have impacted my relationship with Zeke in some level too. So I think that all was in play.
Now that you've really been immersed in this whole notion of sharing for well over a year, coming up on 2 years, I guess. When you look out at the landscape of what's going on in the world today, I mean, through that lens, what are you seeing?
I'm troubled that we seem to be advocating policies that are directly opposed to sharing in a lot of ways. Hmm. I mean, we all know about Moral Mondays and the protests that have been happening here in North Carolina. And I've been interviewing activists like Charlie and Ann Wilson and talking to some people who've been here a long time who know a lot about the history, like Hayes McNeil. And it's not like it's only happening here. I mean, we have these kinds of issues all over the country and outside this country too. But there's this massive discrepancy between the rich and the poor. Charlie Wilson was very much involved with the homeless in Winston-Salem, and he was giving me all these incredible numbers. There were 1,800 people on the street in the 90s per year, 600 homeless a day. And there's all these people who are unemployed. We're in the Great Recession. So how can we pass laws where we're cutting unemployment benefits, both in terms of the dollar amount, but also in terms of the amount of weeks we can get it, and literally refusing expanded federal funds for the unemployed? And how can we be refusing federal funds for expanded Medicaid coverage? I mean, that seems completely antithetical to the idea of sharing. I just don't understand it. And there's a lot of wealth here. There's a lot of mansions and a lot of money in Winston-Salem and in America, but there's a lot of people who don't have it. I don't know where the line is, but clearly people shouldn't be starving and people shouldn't be homeless. The question is what the safety net should be, but it seems obvious that there should be good public education for everyone. There should be good healthcare for everyone. And if we're resistant to that, how can we be resistant to that when we espouse the belief in sharing? Why are we teaching that to our kids? We are because we know it's true. We do want to believe in sharing. But how can we be doing that and then be acting in opposite ways?
Well, I'm going to play devil's advocate now. I've got my big house and I've worked hard and I've given to my community. And why should I feel bad about that?
Yeah, I mean, I hear you. We have a nice house too, and I'm happy about that. I mean, I want that for myself and our kids, but there's a level of guilt that comes with that too, because there's a lot of people who don't have, and I don't think they're directly opposed to each other. One can have a nice life, one can even have a nice house, and still there's enough to go around. People can live well, they can have nice homes, but people don't have to starve to make that occur. I mean, I myself didn't have health care actually for a whole number of years. And I was lucky and I was fine. But, you know, I mean, I'm lucky. I have a nice house. I have a good job. You know, I've been able to be an artist and a filmmaker for a long time and still live well. And that's a blessing. But I do think as a society, we're responsible for each other at some level. And so just in the same way that perhaps Zeke didn't have to share his guitar with his friend, but there were still things that were communal. And it would seem to me that some basic necessities, at the very least, should be communal. Perhaps we're not prepared to redistribute all of our wealth across nations and across borders. But the fact that there's so much inequity, that just troubles me. And I think we're better than that. I think we are... We can do better than that.
Let's talk about the rollout of this project in stages.
Well, this is in a lot of ways the announcement of the project on your show, and I'm grateful to you for the opportunity. The website for the project is now live, thesharingproject.net, and the short film /preview/trailer is also on there. So please check it out. Then in the spring, there's going to be preview events in Los Angeles and in Berlin. We're going to do actually a weekend of, I'm going to screen the preview. We're going to have some panel discussions in relationship to the ideas in this project, which in Berlin, with the whole wall, East Berlin, West Berlin, there's all kinds of issues that are brought up in a different kind of context. In LA, I'm going to do a preview and a talk. So that's this spring 2014. Then the following spring of 2015, there's going to be a sculptural video installation, a very ambitious exhibition with lots of videos, big sculptural component that's going to open in Berlin in the spring, and then it's going to go to LA for June and July, also 2015. And for those people that I've interviewed, the interviews are going to have much more cinematic space and time in the installation than there's room for in the preview video. And then after that, I'll be turning this project into a movie for the big screen. And it looks like it's going to be a feature film, and it'll be my first feature film.
When you're presenting this concept to these, I know you've had longtime associations with the gallery in Los Angeles and one in Berlin, but what hooks them? What, when you're talking to the manager, the curator, what sparks their interest when you've presented it?
Well, I mean, I'm grateful to Suzanne Vilmetter and Stefan Adamski. Suzanne's in LA. I've been working with them for about 10 years each. And so they believe in my work. I feel when I was talking to them about it, I just said that I described the project. I showed them the preview. I showed them this video of Happyville, which I'm not going to show that till the installation, but that's going to be a big part of the installation. I just said that I think this project has the potential to create conversation about something that's very important in our time right now, which is this conversation about sharing, which is connected to the question of how much inequity should there be? What are our responsibilities towards each other? Things that there's been a lot of noise in terms of Occupy Wall Street and all this other stuff in terms of what's been going on with the bankers and people losing their jobs. And I don't want to contribute to the noise. I want to raise questions. And so I'm hopeful, and they believe, and I believe that this conversation will be a productive way to bring up some of these questions in a personal, non-didactic way.